Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, senior fellow here at Bruegel, and the Europe columnist for Reuters Breaking Views. And I am joined today with Nicolas Véran, also a senior fellow at Bruegel, and the author of an upcoming paper on banking union in the European Union, which is the subject of today's podcast. We are so pleased to be joined today by Harald Weiglein, the Director General for Economic Policy and Financial Markets in the Austrian Federal Ministry of Finance. Harald has had a front row seat at the European table throughout these 10 years of banking union through his work. Right now, he's the chair of the Financial Services Committee, which advises the economic affairs ministers of the EU on these sorts of things. He's also been involved with the European Financial Stability Facility and the European Stability Mechanism, which have served in different roles supporting EU member states and their financial sectors throughout. We will get into some of that. So thank you so much, Harald, for joining us. Thank you, Nicolas, for joining us.
My pleasure.
It is now more than 10 years since the 2012 speech that brought banking union onto the EU stage. And I believe banking union began in the second half of 2014. So we're coming up on the 10-year anniversary of that. Nicolas, can you tell us about how this came to pass and what it means?
The short answer on how it came to pass is that there was no other way to go. The idea of banking union, of creating a single framework for banking sector policy so that there would be not just, you know, the general single market framework, but because this is a very heavily regulated industry, a banking sector for the Eurozone and not just for every single one of the member states, that idea has been discussed for decades. It wasn't a new idea in 2012, even so, to some extent, it appeared as such. But it goes back basically to the 1960s. But there was a lot of reluctance because member states are very, very wedded to the idea of having their own domestic banking sector, being able to use it for the purposes of public policy, including financing the government itself. That's what economists call financial repression. And the idea is that, you know, the local banks are their champions. You can call that banking nationalism. So there were massive political obstacles to this idea of banking union, despite the fact that it had been discussed many times. And why did it come in 2012? Just because there was a perception, which I think was also a reality, that if there wasn't a step in the direction of banking union, a significant step, then the euro area might collapse. So it was either or. It was a very difficult choice. It allowed leaders to overcome a lot of political obstacles at the moment of decisions. Even so, the political obstacles, as usual, came back later on in the implementation phase. We'll come to that. But I think that just explains it. There was this vicious circle between the creditworthiness of banks and the creditworthiness of sovereigns. Some observers have called the doom loop between bank and sovereign credit. It was getting completely out of control.
And the banking union has three pillars, is that right? How did those come to be, and which ones do we have already?
So I'm not sure it's right, actually, but it's the way it's been sold to the public. And this has a lot to do with the circumstances of the creation of the banking union. So the three pillars are supervision, resolution, and deposit insurance, and they have been marketed as such almost since the beginning of the sequence in 2012. In a way, it was a very clever packaging, because when you think about it, resolution and deposit insurance are about the same thing. They're about bank crisis management and resolution. But at the time in 2012, there was a very strong political interest in separating them, because everybody understood that deposit insurance was just too difficult politically to be achieved at the European level in that cycle. And therefore, what they said is, we have three, we have supervision, resolution, and deposit insurance, we'll do two out of three. So that's pretty good. In reality, what was done in 2012 was a very significant, I would say even complete, integration of banking supervision. And if you think in a kind of, you know, framework of the International Monetary Fund, you have crisis prevention and crisis management and resolution. So that's kind of half of the program, because it's a crisis prevention bit. And in terms of crisis management, it was, I wouldn't say a comedy of errors, but a sequence of different steps. Initially, it was supposed to be the recapitalization of banks through the European Stability Mechanism, which you mentioned, Rebecca. And then that morphed when it became clear that there was no consensus for that. It morphed into something different, which we call the Single Resolution Mechanism, but which is single in name only. So we still have a bit of a halfway house for bank crisis management and resolution. In the meantime, we have come to a collective understanding that separating resolution from deposit insurance really made no sense, and that's a good evolution in the last few years. But I think the three-pillar narrative has passed its due date. It was very useful politically at the beginning. Now what we have is a pretty complete, pretty effective supervisory system, European Banking Supervision, also known as the Single Supervisory Mechanism, the SSM. And we have a very messy, very complicated, very unfinished business on how to manage crisis. But the good news, and I'll stop there, is that the better the supervision, the less crisis you have. So that shouldn't give complacency, because we need a proper crisis management system, but that buys us a little bit more time to fix it.
So the SSM is now up and running and has been at the European Central Bank, and it is for euro area members. Non-euro members hypothetically could join, but mostly have not, unless they're really on course to join also the euro. Harold, what was it like in the euro crisis as this came together? Talk to us about your experience and how this came to be.
If I think back to those days, I actually, as Nicolas said, I have trouble pinpointing exactly when talks about banking union started, because I remember even when I joined the Ministry of Finance in 2007, we had some initial discussions on European deposit insurance. It was just clear to everybody that Germany would never agree to such a thing, and neither would Austria at the time. But the debate has been there. And by the way, I also have some papers from, I don't know whether it's 2012 or 13, when banking union still had four pillars. In the beginning, we were talking about four pillars, the fourth pillar being the single rule book, but miraculously, I don't know why, I never understood for which reason, this pillar disappeared in the discussions after the first discussions, and we're left with three pillars. To the point, what was it like? I remember that when the banking crisis hit, you know, actually starting with Northern Rock and everything that came afterwards. At first, and this is mostly at the national level, because each one of us had problems with our national banking sectors or one or the other bank running into trouble. It was mostly a bailout discussion and a discussion about costs and how big national protection schemes should be. I remember, for instance, Ireland doing their bit when the financial crisis hit, and Irish debt rising by 30% of GDP over the course of a day, because they actually assumed all the liabilities of their banking sector in a huge bailout operation. Then Germany announcing that they would protect 100% of all their deposits in their banking sector. And that put a huge pressure on the Austrian government to do something similar. That was must have been December 2009, if I remember correctly. And we came up with this protection scheme of potentially 100 billion euros in bailout money for banks and insurance companies. And you have to put that into proportion. I mean, before coming up with that scheme, governments basically went into new elections because they could not agree on tax reforms in the order of 2 million euros. And in the interim period between a general election and the formation of a new government, suddenly we had to put a rescue package of 100 billion euros on the table. That was really massive. And that in turn triggered a discussion. And that was only the beginning in those days. And people were theorizing about whether you could deal with failing banks in a different way, whether you could have living wills and bail-ins and resolution plans. But it was only at the beginning, this discussion. And there were people in the institutions that were completely opposed to such a debate. I remember vividly, for instance, Jean-Claude Trichet, the head of the ECB at the time. He was completely opposed to any form of bail-in. In retrospect, I mean, in a way, I understand him, because nobody knew where this discussion would go. It had never been tested, and even the Americans had second thoughts when it came to bail-in of investment banks, because even their system had only been tested with savings banks, but not with investment banks. And in the one instance where they tried to apply bail-in or let a bank fail, it actually had disastrous consequences. So that was the environment at the time. And I think the debate got pushed forward a bit when Mario Draghi became president of the ECB, because he was more willing to look into those options and let the ECB also look into them. I think that was the tipping point. And I would agree with Nicola, it doesn't matter how you divide up the pillars, but the important thing is the interplay between supervision and resolution or liquidation, if it comes to that, because these are like interlinking cogwheels. You can't have functioning resolution without a very well functioning supervisory system. And I think Silicon Valley is a case in point. It was not possible to have a meaningful or working resolution scheme for a bank where the supervisor had, I think, failed in its task to react to problems identified in the balance sheet. So you need these two elements. And of course, a rule book that is clear, transparent, and predictable. That's what we need to talk about. And in Europe, that specifically refers to the open issues in our resolution framework.
Nicola, you wanted to respond to that. I also, Harold, just have to comment on your summary of the Lehman Brothers failure, because in the U.S., where I was at the time, Lehman Brothers was not a bank. And yet internationally, it certainly was perceived as a failing bank, and it was perceived as a test of a banking crisis management regime, despite coming under very different rules than sort of traditional banks, whether they were savings banks or investment banks. In the U.S., at least, there was a clearer difference between those. Nicola, how do we pull all this together?
Just on the point you just made, it's one of the myriad of traps in the semantics between U.S. and European debates, and we really have different notions under the same words when we talk about resolution, when we talk about lots of things, but also when we talk about the bank, because under European law, Lehman Brothers would have been a bank, but for any American, it's a massive difference that really is meaningful, not just in law, but also in what it means in terms of, you know, a public safety net and so on and so forth. So there are so many interesting quirks in this transatlantic comparison. But back to one of the points that Harald made, I think the episode last year of Silicon Valley Bank and the other problems in the US was very illustrative of a point that I tried to make, and which I think can be controversial. This idea is that with better supervision, you actually make crisis more remote, and therefore you solve a big part of the problem, including when you think of the bank sovereign vicious circle. It shouldn't lead us to complacency. The fact that the banking union is unfinished on the crisis management and resolution side will come back to haunt us. But having that in mind, the contrast last year between the supervisory failure, the words that Harald used is not too strong, in the US, and the lack of that, even with the same macro financial shock, right? The pace of rate increase was comparable on both sides of the Atlantic, but you didn't have the kind of business model failures like Silicon Valley Bank, like Signature Bank in the Eurozone. And I don't think it was just by chance. When you look at what the ECB had been talking about in terms of their risk focus back in 2021, they said interest rate risk, business model risk. This is not with hindsight. This is a document they had at the time. The Fed had nothing comparable. So it seems that we have brought genuine and not just rhetorical improvements in banking supervision in Europe. And I think this has maybe not everything, but a lot to do with the banking union reform.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. If you look at the balance sheet structure of Silicon Valley Bank, it's hard to imagine a European supervisor not being very frightened about the interest rate risk present in the balance sheet and actually reacting to this. I think the supervisors in the US tried to react, but for reasons not really known to me, they did not. And I think people are also not aware that the most important job of a supervisor is to pull the plug early enough on a bank. Not to save a bank from failing, but to actually pull the plug before it fails. It's only then that a proper resolution can actually work. And that's what the US authorities clearly did not do.
Interesting, but I cannot resist, sorry, Rebecca, asking hard about Credit Suisse, because is Credit Suisse a case of the authorities pulling the plug early enough, or is it a supervisory failure in your view?
That's a very good question. Because you can look at events in very different ways, and what triggered the failure of UBS was basically a statement by one of the most important shareholders.
Jeez. Yes. You said UBS.
but now it's the same. It was one of the most important shareholders saying something in a press conference that was interpreted as not being willing to provide further support and money to the bank. And that amplified previous concerns about what's actually going on in the bank. Probably the new element here is, which was also present in SVB, by the way, is how social media can increase the speed of a bank run. And that makes it even more important for a supervisor to react quickly. I think the more blatant mistake in the UBS, Credit Suisse cause is the disrespect for the creditor hierarchy in the eventual bailouts. That sent a massive shock through the European banking sector. I mean, the ECB did their best to calm down markets and it worked. But that, I think, was a huge mistake because it discredited a certain type of capital instrument throughout the globe.
I am loving this conversation about the overlap between the U.S. banking system, the euro area banking system, the EU banking system, the Swiss banking system. It really shows that finance is very much a web, even when you have these different regulatory regimes. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the political climate that got us to where we are today. Welcome back to The Sound of Economics. Harold, you mentioned earlier that Austria was initially a skeptic about federalizing at the European level some of these things. Can you talk to us about how opinions changed and also about the vanguard example that you set with the Vienna Initiative?
Basically, what changed opinion, not just in Austria, but also in the European Union, was the massive costs of bank bailouts. And that triggered a political backlash. People were talking about special taxes for banks and what could be done better in the case of a banking crisis. And the idea that taxpayers should not bail out failing banks or pay for private institutions' mistakes became very powerful, actually irresistible. And that's why governments were more willing to look into that as a way also to avoid huge costs or potential costs or liabilities for national budgets. I think that was the big change. And in Austria, there was the case of Hypo-Alpe Adria, which proved to be hugely expensive with all the political elements involved, you know, this being a bank dominated by a right-wing populist government in Carinthia. When it failed, all the bank's dodgy dealings emerged, all the sorts of businesses that banks should not be engaged in. And of course, that all led to the question, why should taxpayers have to pay for this mismanagement? Why should it not be those people who should actually monitor the bank's risk and these other people on the liability side of the balance sheet?
And what about international cooperation? It's one thing to say that we need to take this away from taxpayers. It's quite another thing to say we really need to work cross borders, even when that increases our liability, at least on paper.
No, absolutely. I think this is part of the unfinished business because, unfortunately, banking union or the open bits of banking union have been taken over by the home host issue, which I personally think has nothing to do with a functioning banking union, but it's a political element that some people use to achieve their objectives in other areas not related to banking union. But that's definitely something that warrants further discussions. And it has to do with one of the basic questions connected to the beginning of the banking union. Because when we started discussing potential cross-border resolution in Europe or even in the euro area, it's clear that there are costs associated with that. And what people did not want or were not willing to opt for was the responsibility for these costs to be at another level than supervision. So the basic idea is if you set up a fund or whatever, a European entity, for the costs of a banking resolution, then the authority that actually triggers a resolution cannot be at the national level, because then the incentive is to push problems to the European level for which you bear national responsibility. To be, in other words, lenient in supervision because you know there's a European bailout fund. So it was very clear very early on that European resolution scheme can only work with European supervision.
Coming up on this, this was very much an argument of the German government, right? Responsibility has to rest at the same level as the liability and the risk sharing and the funds in case they're needed. How does that not read across to deposit insurance? Because if you take that simple principle, that means now we have European supervision, we should have deposit insurance, which is very much part of this liability or crisis management at the European level as well. But that's not the position of the German government. So what explains that?
I agree. It's a bit paradoxical. And by the way, at the time, it was not just the Germans. I remember the Swedes, they were pushing this argument very strongly. So it was not just a German thing. But I completely agree. It's a bit paradoxical that you only go halfway, because I think it has to do with a certain sensitivity of terms and concepts. I mean, what is the single resolution fund in its essence? I mean, it is a deposit insurance fund. It just doesn't fulfill all the functions of a deposit guarantee fund. But it's got a different name, so maybe that's why the Germans could agree to it. In a way, it's half a deposit guarantee fund, but only for certain banks under certain circumstances. And that's why I normally say it's like a bridge that extends halfway across the river. And if you don't need to go further than halfway across the river, you don't have a problem. Problem starts when you need to get to the other side. And here, I think that's one of the paradoxical elements of this debate, that it should actually be a very technical debate. And if you talk about it in technical terms, at the technical level, people agree on most of the issues, even the German banking sector. When I travel to Germany or even to the Netherlands to discuss functioning concept of the European deposit guarantee scheme, I mean, the sector agrees with me. It's just that it's become very, very politicized. Sometimes people are just exchanging catchphrases and catchwords, but there's no deeper understanding what it actually means. And I think that's part of the debate.
Just to help our listeners catch up, the Vienna Initiative was a 2009 project that it went on for at least 10 years for financial sector stakeholders to get together and talk about important issues. And that really served as a model for the type of euro area and beyond cooperation that we've seen that led to banking euro and beyond. At least I think there's a case to be made.
Right. I forgot to talk about the Vienna Initiative.
No, it's cool. I want to come back and tie it all together. I also want to share with our listeners about home and host situations, because this is something that is very hotly debated for people who are following the current policy debate. What this essentially means is you have a bank that operates in multiple countries, which supervisor is in charge of pulling the plug and how do they handle it? Is it the one where the bank is headquartered? Is it the one where the bank may have a subsidiary that is doing questionable deeds? How do they work together? How do they keep a decision by regulators in one country from having the bad kind of spillovers on the economy in another? Having euro area wide supervision is certainly something that can help with that, because at least in theory, you have an across the piece view of all of that. Nicola, how do we approach that, given that not all of the banks are subject to daily supervision by the ECB, only some of them? Do you think we're getting the right banks at the operational level of this banking union?
I would take your question as two. One is about the smaller banks and whether it's fine to have the kind of delegation of supervisory tasks to national authorities as we currently have in the SSM regulations, the legislation that creates European banking supervision. And here my short answer will be yes, it's okay. I will elaborate briefly. The second question is about this home host issue and how to overcome it, right? Because indeed, if you have a banking union, in principle, you have a single banking sector and there should not be home and hosts within the Eurozone. There can be, if you talk about the UK, Switzerland or Sweden, but not within the Eurozone. We shouldn't have a difference between, say, you know, Belgium, France and Netherlands. And currently we do. So let's take them maybe in that order. Smaller banks, it's been the big German win, if you will, in the negotiation of the legislation that created the European banking supervision. So the European Commission's proposal for that legislation in September 2012 put all the banks, no matter how small, and that includes institutions that in the US would be called credit unions, for example, put them all under the supervisory authority of the European Central Bank, of the ECB. The Germans said, no, we have a lot of small banks, they need... There is a subsidiarity principle, therefore they should be exempted. The compromise was that, yes, the smaller banks, what is called in the jargon the less significant institutions, would be supervised on a day-to-day basis by the national authority, in Germany that's BaFin, but, and that's a very important but, that's under something called supervisory oversight, which means that the European Central Bank actually has second-level control of this and can intervene if things get wrong. And many people were cynical at the beginning about it, but actually it seems to work much better than some people feared. But the best example of that is what happened with the savings bank system in Germany. This hasn't been much commented in the media. There was actually only one article I'm aware of, which made the savings banks very unhappy. But BaFin, the German authority, and the ECB have jointly acted to recommend, in plain language, to force a reform of the savings bank system to make it indeed easier to intervene in cases of saving bank failures. That was a few years ago. And that shows that even for that core of the German small bank system, the savings banks, very politically powerful, the ECB is not out of the picture. So I think the extent to which the differentiation has been made by the SSM regulation between larger banks, significant institutions, and smaller banks, I think that can easily be exaggerated. And actually, we have a single supervisory system that deserves its name of single supervisory mechanism. It's single not only in name, but also in reality. When it comes to the home and host, I will be briefer, Rebecca, and I will only say that one, there is a kind of logical and a more political argument for, you know, ring fencing of the capital and liquidity of subsidiaries of large banking groups in the Eurozone. So what happens is that in a host country, pick your name, they do this ring fencing, which means they impose on the domestic subsidiary requirements of capital and liquidity, which shouldn't happen in an integrated banking space. I think the logical argument for this is to say, at this point, we don't have an integrated safety net. We still have national deposit insurance. We still have a certain likelihood that if something goes really wrong, there will be a need for fiscal resources and they will be at the national, not the European level because we don't have a fiscal union. And therefore, we need to protect our domestic deposit insurance, our national taxpayers. And that requires ring fencing. And then there is a more political argument, which I think is actually more powerful and drives more of the action, which is we want to keep a domestic banking sector under domestic political control. So the interplay between these two narratives is very difficult to disentangle. It's very interesting. And I think this is a big part, as you suggested. It's not the only part. I hope we will reserve time to discuss sovereign exposures, maybe one area where Harald and I have different perspectives. But it's a big part of why we still have an unfinished banking union.
Harald, while we're still on this topic, can you come back to this issue of sharing sovereignty and giving up sovereignty? I had invoked the Vienna Initiative earlier. Would you agree with that characterization as sort of a vanguard, or do you think there were other factors that made people be more willing to share this competence?
Well, it was the issue of costs in the end. And in a way, the home host issue is a reflection of that, because you have to imagine the political situation where you have a large bank in your country that is actually a subsidiary of a foreign bank supervised in another country, and that bank goes bust. You have the political problems of hundreds of thousands of savers potentially losing part of their money or all of their money back in the day, and no influence over the situation because the supervisory authority is in another country. And I think some of the host countries remember such experiences from the financial crisis, and they're still traumatized by that. But it's not a rational fear, because in those days, we did not have a resolution framework. Now we have a resolution framework with very clear rules for capital and liquidity buffers. And they try to be super cautious. I think that's the ring fencing element that Nicola pointed out. And if you look, for instance, at the Czech Republic and the Austrian banks there, the national supervisor always assumes very stressed scenarios when it comes to the prescription of capital buffers. And that's, of course, hugely costly for a banking operation, because you're a far cry from managing your liquidity or capital in an efficient way throughout the banking group. And that's one of the competitive disadvantages of the European financial sector to the US. In a way, one of the arguments of the hosts is precisely that. They're saying, you know, if a subsidiary of, say, Erste Bank in Romania fails, it'll be our national deposit guarantee scheme that needs to pick up the pieces. So as long as we don't have EDIS, we need to have a different means of reassuring the hosts that they will not unduly have to bear costs. But that, in a way, would actually mean, if this debate were logical, that the hosts should be very much in favor of EDIS, which is not the case. They connect their support for EDIS to a string of other conditions, which in practice would mean they can still ring fence, even though EDIS exists. So that I think in my mind, that always shows how disconnected this debate has become from the actual technical reality of reaching banking union in the end. And on the Vienna initiative had in the beginning a very specific set of circumstances from which it was born. This was actually a bit before the big European banking crisis. It was the crisis that we in Austria call the Eastern European crisis, because there was a huge deposit outflow from particularly Austrian institutions in the East, of fear that Austrian institutions might crash in the wake of Hypo Alpe Adria. And there was a need to reassure savers in Eastern Europe that, first of all, Austrian banks would not pull the plug on subsidiaries. They would provide liquidity and capital if necessary, so that all deposits in Eastern Europe are safe. That was an assurance that the Austrian banking sector gave early on. But that wasn't quite enough, because there was some macroeconomic circumstances that actually made stability in some of those countries a lot more difficult. And that's why institutions like the IMF, World Bank, the international financial institutions were also needed to cooperate with the banks to provide a framework consisting of cooperation, but also the provision of financial means through the IFIs and the banking sector to reassure people that their deposits were safe and to prevent bank runs in those countries. That was actually the birth of the Vienna initiative. Now it's, perhaps I'm being harsh in my judgment now, it has turned into something slightly different now. When I read the protocols of recent Vienna initiative meetings, it's mostly become the battleground and playground between home and host countries. But again, I think we're in a different situation now. We have sort of a resolution framework with open issues, that's true. But in the case of the large cross-border banks, those are supervised by the SSM, and those would clearly meet the public interest assessment. And for them, that system would actually work. Whether it would work in an optimal way is another question, but it would work. There's a framework in place here.
Thank you for that overview. I have personally found that when I was in the crisis reporting on it, it was very difficult to see some of these lessons from Central and Eastern Europe and from other parts of the world. And with the benefit of hindsight, adding those puzzle pieces, for me anyway, makes it easier to see how we got to where we are. Nicolas.
It's a wonderful example of what you're referring to, Rebecca, which I only discovered to full extent recently. We didn't invent supranational banking supervision in Europe. The first who did supranational banking supervision in a monetary union were, to a very messy extent, in the Eastern Caribbean, but to a more consistent extent in West Africa and Central Africa. They created their single supervisory mechanism in 1990. And I've asked some of the founding fathers of banking unions, European banking supervision, whether they had looked, not necessarily for inspiration, but just for benchmarking at the experience of how that came up, what were the difficulties. And it appears it didn't, which is quite an extreme example of what you say, because obviously the circumstances of Western and Central Africa are vastly different from the circumstances of the Eurozone. But actually, when you look at how they came to the idea, it was the same thing. They had a single monetary system, and they discovered that they couldn't sustain the single currency area without a single supervision of banks. So the parallels are fascinating, and the fact that there was no learning from there, apparently, is also fascinating.
When we come back, we'll talk more about EDIS, the European Deposit Insurance Scheme that has been proposed, and some of its ramifications. As we close out this episode of The Sound of Economics, we have to talk about the unfinished business in banking union, which includes deposit insurance and also its smaller sibling, the crisis management initiative that the commission put forward because deposit insurance is stuck. The goal of these is to increase confidence that a euro saved in one country is just as good as a euro saved in any other, about which people have fears given the way these things are kept in buckets. So that's where we're stuck. Nicolas, talk to us about how we get unstuck. You've had this idea that by looking at how risky national debts are, that can somehow balance out the risk of national banking systems.
Okay, let me rephrase that a little bit, because you're referring to sovereign exposures of banks in the Eurozone. And indeed, my contention here would be, and this goes against the narrative of three pillars of the banking union, you know, supervision box ticked, resolution box kind of ticked, and deposit insurance remaining business. Actually, that's not what we've seen in the dynamic of the negotiations. And there is a huge elephant in the room here, which is the fact that banks in the Eurozone hold massive portfolios of exposures to their domestic country sovereigns. So, you know, banks in Austria having Austrian debt, it's not the most extreme case. Bank in France having French debt and so on and so forth. And that is a massive driver, not the only one, of the bank sovereign vicious circle, which nearly killed the Eurozone back in 2011, 2012. But it's a bit of a taboo topic. To my knowledge, the European Commission has never really published a paper about it, for example, let alone a legislative proposal to address this issue. So if you think of the banking union now, you actually have not one, but two big roadblocks. You have European Deposit Insurance, as you mentioned, the acronym is EDIS for European Deposit Insurance Scheme. And you have concentrated sovereign exposures, for which there also is a four-letter acronym, Regulatory Treatment of Sovereign Exposures, RTSC, but nobody wants to talk about in public. Even so, in the negotiations that, you know, Harald chairs in the Financial Services Committee and so on, there have been tons of discussions about that. So I think we need to recognize, and maybe Harald will disagree on this, that we have an imbalance in the discussion, in the public perception of banking union, in the negotiation about how to fix it. If I'm correct, but Harald will correct me if I'm not, the collapse of the discussion about completing the banking union that happened in June 2022, there was a disastrous Eurogroup meeting about it, was driven by the issue of sovereign exposures. It was basically, sorry for mentioning a country, Italy, saying, no way, we're not doing this. So end of the discussion. And if we don't start to recognize that this issue needs addressing to, in a way, a similar extent as European deposit insurance, I think we will stuck in stalemate as we have been for so many years.
What do you think, Carol?
I think Nicola is referring to a political reality. Some countries insist that we need to have a regulatory treatment of sovereign exposures to be able to make progress in banking union. I think in the case of the Netherlands, they really mean it. In Germany, I think it's just an argument to kill banking union, because even if we had a regulatory treatment of sovereign exposure, they would not agree because the Sparkassen just hate the idea. But in technical terms, I also happen to think it's a distraction, because if you had a completely functioning resolution regime, and with that I mean one where a strict least cost test is applied, and every liability that can be used for bail-in will actually be bailed in, then the narrative that the Germans and the Dutch have, namely that banks would just buy their own sovereign debt because they know at some point they will be rescued by a European deposit guarantee scheme, it would not work, because nobody in their right mind would want to go into a resolution process where practically those people who did not monitor the bank properly or the risks properly would lose a substantial amount of money. So that would be addressed in a functioning system. And where I also think the argument for RTSE is plain wrong is that it's true that in some sectors we see a high concentration, or higher concentration as in others, in sovereign bonds in the banking sector. But that problem is comparatively small when you look at other exposures on the asset side. You know, the loan portfolio that is much more risky than the sovereign bonds is even more concentrated. That's a feature of our single market in financial services not actually working, because there's very little cross-border loan provision. And here the risks are even more concentrated. So I would think if you have RTSE in terms of disconnection from the sovereign, and by the way, I have to say something on the history of the doom loop too, that would not make, you know, in terms of actually reducing the risk, it would not make a lot of difference. And Nicola mentioned the doom loop. I remember the discussions. They were actually triggered off by the Irish case. A sovereign clearly infected by its failing banking sector. And I mentioned, you know, debt increasing by 30% of GDP within one day. And that actually brought the Irish sovereign into trouble and triggered a sovereign debt crisis in Ireland. So that was the loop as we understood it then. That was the loop we wanted to break in council conclusions and in conclusions of the European Council. And it was only a couple of years later, when we started about EDIS, that people began to interpret this doom loop in another way, namely that we should also insulate a financial sector from potential problems of the sovereign. The problem with that is that there are many infection channels from a sovereign to a bank, and I think a lot more are connected, for instance, to the loan portfolio. It's not just the probability of a sovereign default or the macroeconomic picture. So the second idea, you know, actually protecting a financial sector from a defaulting sovereign is much more difficult, probably even impossible. And you can actually see it in the ratings. There is, I think, only one example in the world where a financial institution has a better rating than its sovereign. And this is a very well-run institution in Spain.
This is so interesting. I, having started my career in the United States, always saw a very clear difference between a bank, which is a business that could fail, and a sovereign, which is a political idea and therefore needs total credibility. So it has always seemed to me a bit strange to add riskiness and therefore diminish credibility of a sovereign. And yet, for technical reasons, we can see why the debate has ended up there. Going forward, we've seen the lessons of the crisis. We saw in this sort of, I will say, dead end experiment about helping banks without going through sovereign balance sheets. At one point, there was talk of direct recapitalization of banks without involving the sovereign for all of these reasons you discuss. And when they tried it at the European Stability Mechanism, just as a exercise to see how it would work, they found there was no way to help the banks without also triggering the need for some sort of rescue program for the sovereign. So these things are all very interconnected. As we finish this podcast, and I know the three of us could talk about this for another hour, but probably we need to close up. Where would you like listeners to go next? What would you like them to be thinking about as they go forward, in addition to waiting for Nicolas's paper, which will be wonderful? Nicolas.
You know, the world is a big place, so there are so many places to go. I think what struck me most, it's not entirely an answer to your question, Rebecca, but what struck me most in, you know, doing this kind of retrospective work on banking union is two things. First, how much history there was before 2012, and including, by the way, at the time of the negotiation of the Maastricht Treaty. These issues are not new at all. They have been discussed at length in previous phases. And what has been achieved with European banking supervision, something which is now facts on the ground, it's up and running, it's working, is essentially the full realization of the wildest utopian dreams of the people who were involved in those discussions back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, early 2000s. They didn't think of anything beyond a single rule book and a single supervisor. They thought this would be impossible to attain in the European context, and they didn't even mention, with very few exceptions, issues about resolution and crisis management. Why? Because they had the same prior as you had, Rebecca, which is a sovereign doesn't fail. And therefore, crisis can be addressed by sovereign fiscal resources without that representing a problem. So what strikes me, and that's my last point, is the extraordinary collective learning we have gone through. We have learned a lot of things through this crisis, the most prominent of which, to me, being the bank sovereign vicious circle, which indeed has several drivers to it. Concentrated sovereign exposures is only one of them, but it is one of them. And the fact that we really can build a policy agenda based on that learning. We know more than we did 20, 30 years ago, or even 10 years ago. And that brings forward an agenda for reforms. And there are, you know, many political obstacles. We mentioned already some of them. There are many more. But we also saw at the point of decision in 2012 under extreme pressure that the political obstacles could be overcome. The striking thing about the decision on the single supervisory mechanism is Harald mentioned the Sparkassen, hugely powerful, hugely influential interest in Germany, the biggest country of the Eurozone. They didn't have a voice in the decision. When it came to decision point, they were not listened to. And I think there are many lessons here.
Yes, indeed. If you want me to come in right away.
I certainly do.
I think one of the dangers of Silicon Valley Bank and the Swiss case is the way the US reacted actually threw us back to an earlier time in the debate, because now people are questioning whether we can really apply our resolution framework in a crisis. And the argument is, look, the US also didn't do it, which is a bit disingenuous, because the US did not bail out a bank. They essentially bailed out the tech sector. That was the reason for the way the authorities reacted with SVB. But now the danger is, of course, that we go back to bailouts, because people are saying, look, it's all well and good with those resolution frameworks, but it's very clear that it's very dangerous to apply them, and you cannot apply them fully, which were also the arguments back in the day when people refused to think about resolution. You know, the argument then was, of course, as Nicolas said, the sovereign cannot fail. But another argument was, as soon as you only think about bail-in, people will just start a bank run, because they will think their deposits and their bonds will not be safe, and they will desert the banking sector, and there'll be a system-wide bank run, which of course hasn't happened. It has to do with expectations management. You know, if people understand the risk of holding a bank's liabilities and they know what can happen, then it should not be a surprise. And I think by now questioning the framework triggered by the actions of the US supervisors and also the FDIC, because I think their reaction to SVB and other banks has not been optimal, runs the risk of actually undermining the confidence in what we have achieved. And it might actually bring us back to a discussion that we have actually already solved. That's the danger, and I would like to avoid that. And in general, as a way forward for Europe, let me just say this, because I'm trying to say this in all the panels. It's actually quite simple, because there is a best practice model in resolution, which is normally the FDIC. They have a very strict least cost test. They have a very clear framework. And we should just go for such a system. One fund, one system of rules for all banks. And that would be the key.
That is such a hopeful way to leave this conversation. And I have really appreciated talking about the really global banking environment, as well as the last 10 years of EU Banking Union. Nicolas, thanks for joining us. Harold, thanks.
My pleasure.
This has been The Sound of Economics, the podcast of Bruegel. You can find all of our papers and research on Bruegel.org, and you can find this podcast on all of your favorite podcast channels. Thanks for joining us, and see you next time.